Hi, my name is Eliane Goldstein, and you're listening to The Effect on Us.
But I remember being on the street in the morning watching the German tanks coming into Budapest and occupying every area.
I was born in a camp. My mother was having, during her pregnancy, to work underground in digging coal. They were prisoners.
My father gave me a blessing on Shabbat. We came home from the synagogue. My father would bless all the children. He told me that if I manage to survive, I need to tell the world what happened. And he said, go.
The Effect on Us is a podcast for people of all ages to learn about the Holocaust and the events that took place during that time. My goal is to reach as many people as I can all over the world and help educate them about the tragedy that took place during that time and the effect the Holocaust had on people from Generation 1 to Generation 3. I started this project in April 2021, just before my 13th birthday, and so far, I've interviewed survivors on 4 different continents. Join me on my mission to make the world a better place. Did you know that a common statistic claims 11 million people were murdered by the Nazis? 6 million Jews and 5 million others. While the number of the 6 million Jews is supported by evidence, the 5 million others are not and could actually be much more than that. The number was invented by the Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal. In this episode, I'm talking to Joe Sabrin, who was born in the Vilna Ghetto and years later wrote a book called We Dare to Live.
What's your name?
Joseph Sabrin.
When were you born?
December 21st, 1942, in the Vilna Ghetto.
So how old does that make you now?
I just turned 80 in December.
Happy late birthday then.
Yes.
So can you tell me about what your family was like?
My mother never told me much. She did survive. My father, as I did my research for my dad's memoir, turns out he didn't get to Vilna until April 1943. I was born December 21st, 1942. I sort of suspected it growing up, but he's not my natural father. But he's still my father. He and several of his, I guess, heroic fighters went under the sewers in Vilna to the Rudniki Forest, and they became partisans and did everything they could to disrupt the Nazi regime. Thankfully, as the years went by, I gave my dad a Yiddish typewriter for his 60th birthday. And I said, Dad, if you don't tell me what you did, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren will not know what you did to survive and what you did to the Nazi regime. So he pecked away, and I kept asking him, as the years went by, how many pages have you typed? Well, I got 500 pages. Ironically, I didn't get the manuscript until we sat Shiva for him. So he's gone. It'll be, September will be 22 years that he's no longer here. As I said, my mother really didn't give me any information. She just kept telling me it was too hard to talk. But I did speak to one of his fighters in Tel Aviv, Joseph Halmatz, who unfortunately is no longer with us. I asked, what did my mother do during, you know, while you and everybody else and my father were fighting and killing Nazis? He said, he really didn't say much. And then over the years, about 6 or 7 years ago, my son said to me, Dad, tell me about your childhood. I said, funny you should ask. I wish I knew my childhood. I mean, your grandmother, snuck out of the ghetto where I was with her and my father was fighting and gave me the Polish farmers. And she said she had a map of where I was moved from farmer to farmer, non-Jewish farmers, of course. And when it was safe, she would sneak out of the ghetto to come visit me and make sure I was safe. I said, how long was I hidden? She said, about a year and a half. And then I said to her, and she said, well, it wasn't really a year and a half, it was 9 months. So I said, okay, where was I the other 9 months? No answer. So I must have been somewhere. Thankfully, after the liberation of Vilna by the Russians, I believe in 1944, I have the exact date somewhere. My parents heard that children that survived were in an orphanage in Vilna. So they went to visit the orphanage. And my mother pointed to me, and you know, the person in charge said, how do we know this is your child? Well, he's got a birthmark here, he's got a birthmark there, you know, he's my child. I know he's my child. So my father, thankfully, knew the doctor that delivered me, and he was still alive. So he went and got him. He came back to the orphanage with my dad, and he did verify that I was their child. He took me. I have a picture of them carrying me, I guess, from the ghetto, I guess. I must have been going from the orphanage. It's, I don't know if you can see it. There's no date on it. And they, like other survivors, we were sent to
displacement camp?
A camp, a deportation camp. And we wound up in Germany, which, of course, didn't make us very happy. It didn't make my parents very happy. And it was a town called Bad Tierheim. Now they just call it Tierheim. And what I do remember is going to Catholic school because you couldn't admit to being Jewish in post-war Germany. I made, you know, the cross. And I remember the young German children in school would throw stones at me, you know, saying, "Du bist der Jude, you're a Jew." I got over it. Then my father started communicating with his first cousin in Brooklyn, and we got papers to come to New York City. My father actually wanted to go to Israel with his other fighters. They all became Yergun. And my mother said, "You can go without me. I'm going with my son to New York City. I'm not going to Israel." We wound up in Manhattan, and my father belonged to one or two organizations. Actually, while we were in Germany, he did speak at a national conference. It's in the book. And then he would give me bits and pieces, and thankfully, like I said, he documented everything that he remembered in his memoir. I did speak to someone whose father was the gatekeeper of the Vilna Ghetto. He also published a book about his dad. He did mention that children of Holocaust survivors, more than 50% don't have kids. Why, I don't know, but then I would have liked to have more, but I have a beautiful daughter who's 50 and my son is 47. Three grandchildren as well.
I have a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
So the first one was, when you said that your father was fighting the Nazis, what exactly did you mean by that?
He was a commander. He had 120 fighters in his command, 89 men, 31 women. Of course, in the memoir, you know, he lost some. He didn't lose that many. He only lost about 6-7. They all survived. And they blew up bridges, trains. They were stationed in the Rudytny Forest, which is now Vilnius, Lithuania. And we did go for a visit about 6-7 years ago. We went and hired a guide to take us for 2 days. He showed us the sewers where my dad went underground. He showed us the bunkers where they showed, you know, where they were encamped, and they, you know, they went back and forth as the missions were needed. So his fighter in Tel Aviv, Joseph Holmitz, told me on the phone, he says, "The only one we trusted with a weapon was your father. He trained others, because at 16, he was in the Polish army. And then he left the Polish army to join the Russian army. But once the Russians were so scattered, he didn't have any papers to go anywhere. He left the Russian army and became a partisan with people that he knew in Vilna, you know, that he met in the ghetto."
Do you have any memories from the time of the war or from after?
The only memories I have are of post-Germany.
What was that like?
You know, like I said, I went to Catholic school. My father was on the road in Germany selling bedding. And there was a piece about, I guess, 20 years ago. I have the video. That Koppel, who had a TV show on Channel 7 at late night. My wife is a late night TV. She's watching him, and she yells at me and says, "You got to see this." So I take a look, and there are a group called the Avengers. And all of a sudden, I had a flashback to my home in Germany. I said, all these people were in my place in Germany. These are my dad's fighters. And their plan was to poison all the, after the war, to poison all the Germans in the prisons, the Nazis in the prisons. But the whole plan blew up. So one night I confronted my father and I said, Dad, were you an Avenger? He says, oh, those guys didn't know what they were doing. So if he didn't agree with the plan, he would not be part of it. And there was also a piece that broke about also 25, 30 years ago called The Partisans of Vilna. It was a film. I don't remember the producer's name. I remember him being filmed for it when he lived in Sayreville, New Jersey, not far, about 20 minutes from where we lived. And my dad was asked to see the preview, and he said to the producer, you're going to take me out of this film. She said, why? Because I will not be part of someone that's lying about what they did. And that was one of the reasons that my dad really didn't want to come forward. I mean, a lot of people came forward, and, you know, you got Ellie, you know, who's a Nazi hunter. And I'm watching The Hunters now. It's kind of intense. I would wait a couple more years before you watch it. It's kind of a tough, tough movie about, you know, a group of people looking to, in the 70s, trying to find the Nazis. And they still exist. I saw the preview, I saw the movie, and I was invited to the premiere, and my father's face is on the front of the movie, but he's not in it. So that's, it's kind of hard because I had absolutely no, you know, some people call me a child survivor, but I don't think, you know, most child survivors were a lot older. You know, they were in their teens. You know, they found ways to survive. My wife's two cousins, may they rest in peace, you know, were put on a kinder train. I mean, they're no longer here. I mean, one passed away at 96 and the other one passed away at 94. So they're, you know, I'm 80, so the senior was 16 years older than me. And I know I did go to a child survivor reunion, and I forget what city. And I was the youngest one there. So, you know, to recollect and come up with a specific story, you know, like Sammy did, you know, he had a lot of specifics because he remembered, you know, most of it. And it was tragic. But I really didn't have any tragic moments except my parents trying to, you know, get me out of the orphanage to make sure. And I have no birth certificate. So in order to become a U.S. citizen, we arrived in New York City, August 6, 1949. And in 1954, to become a citizen, my parents had to find someone that knew me and have a notarized affidavit that I am who I am. So, you know, my original name was Yurik Shabrinsky. You know, my Hebrew name was Joseph. And we changed our name in 54 after we became citizens from Shabrinsky to Sabrin because my cousin who brought us here, they came before the war, my dad's first cousin had changed his name to Sabrin from Shabrinsky. So in my anecdotal memoir, I'm going to try to remember, you know, as much as I can, but most of it's going to be, you know, what I accomplished as, you know, as a child coming to America in 1949 with my parents, and, you know, they had $7 and two children, and then my baby brother was born. So it's not Horatio Alger's story, but, you know, the toughness that my, you know, I remember in business when people say, I have it tough. I said, yeah, did your dad work three jobs for 50 cents an hour so he could feed two kids and pay $16 a month rent on the Lower East Side with no bathroom? They would look at me, what do you mean? I said, yeah, in 1949, you were lucky to get a place to live. So we did move to the Bronx with my cousins who had health issues. They moved to Colorado, and we got their place up in the Bronx. And I thought at that point my family was multimillionaires. Little did I know that my dad still had to work hard. Yeah.
So growing up in post-war Germany, going to Catholic school, were you guys practicing religion?
No.
Do you practice now?
We moved to the Bronx. I was 11. My dad's uncle, Muscle, would take me by my ear. He was Orthodox, and take me to shul. I attended Hebrew high school. I started with a rabbi when I came off when I was 7 on the Lower East Side at the East Side Hebrew Institute. And I sat side by side with him studying. I wanted to be Orthodox. Moved to the Bronx. I said, well, not so much. But my uncle Muckle dragged me. I went to junior high school. Then I was offered a scholarship for rabbinical studies when I was 14 at Yeshiva University, but I had to attend their high school first, which is hard to get to from the Bronx. It was in Washington Heights. So I called Yeshiva and I said, can I go to regular high school with my friends, who I went to junior high school with, and pick up my scholarship when I finish high school at DeWitt Clinton and attend Yeshiva University. By my sophomore year in high school, I did research on which synagogue would I want to be a rabbi at. So I gave Yeshiva University a list of all the affluent synagogues, Manhattan, New Jersey, Connecticut. They said, we can't guarantee where you're going to land as a rabbi. You know, as the need comes up, you know, you'll go where it's like teaching. You know, you can't pick the school you're going to be at. You can transfer. Once you start, you can transfer to another school. Same with, you know, being a rabbi. Well, after learning a little bit about capitalism in high school, I said, I'm going to switch to becoming a capitalist. I'm going to go to a real college and learn about business and make some money that my family doesn't have to worry about, you know, where their next nickel is coming from. So I received a 50-cent scholarship to Harvard, 50% scholarship to MIT. And my parents looked at me and I said, where do we get the other 50%? 50%. They didn't have it. So I went to CCNY. All the Jewish kids went for $8 a semester, which is the equivalent of, at that time, of Harvard. After about 2 semesters, I realized I didn't want to be in college anymore. I was walking along in the Bronx. I didn't like the Bronx. I didn't like college. I didn't like my friends. I saw a sign that said, big sign, said, join the army and see the world. I was 17 already. I was already in college. I did the 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade in 1 year. When I came to America, they put me in the 1st grade. I should have been in the 2nd grade. So I walked in, and a recruiter looked at me and said, how old are you? I said, I'm 17. He said, will your parents give you permission to join the army? I said, do you know any Jewish parents that will give their child permission to join the army? This is the Cold War. It was way before your time. And Russia and America were yelling at each other. So I said, what do I do? I said, well, you have to wait till you're 18. At 18, you don't need permission. So I did another semester at college, and I still didn't change my mind. I went back to the recruiter. I told my parents I'm going to Fort Dix to basic training, and then I don't know where I'm going to go. The Army will send me somewhere. Ironically enough, they sent me to Germany, and they weren't very happy about it. So I did my 2 years, 9 months, and 1 day. Even though I enlisted for 3 years, I read every regulation to get out early. And the only thing I could do is go back to college early because I applied for the January semester and then my discharge was April. So it let me out early to start college in January. And I went back to Baruch, which is also a New York City school of business. And I sat down with my accounting professor after class one day and I said, I'm 21 years old. I work for IBM. I have $30,000 cash in a bank. I want to be in business. Let me find an employer that will allow me to work for them and maybe inherit part of the business. They have no children. I couldn't find one. And usher at my wedding, Lenny, who doesn't live far from me here, he lives in Boca, I live in Delray, introduced me to the staffing business, the recruiting business. So, of course, since I knew a little bit about technology, working for IBM, I was the first in Manhattan to place data processing people in jobs. I did very well. I went to my two owners and I said, I'm not here that long, but I think we ought to start a specialty firm that only does, at that time, called data processing. Lo and behold, I had 3 businesses. I learned a lot. And people still ask me to this day to do technology recruiting. I started talking to, in Florida, I started talking to eighth graders on up about my dad's book. I've given a ton away. I said, I'm not looking to make money. I'm looking to make sure that my dad's, what my dad did, doesn't go away, and that I use it to help young people understand that not everybody, you know, whoever had the might and the desire to live was able to. You know, it's unfortunate. You know, I mean, when I went to visit Yad Vashem, I was in the children's wing, and we were with friends who's actually have a, not a blood nephew, but a teaching rabbi nephew in Efrat Israel, and his parents were, and I were there, and we went to the Yad Vashem, and there's, you know, they're showing the 1.5 million children that didn't make it, and we started crying. I wasn't one of them. I don't know if you read about this young grandson of a Holocaust survivor who went on TikTok.
Oh, I know who you're talking about, but there could be two. There's
he did a TikTok with his grandmother.
I know who you're talking about.
It was amazing. I mean, I don't use TikTok, but when I heard about it, I went on and I listened to it. The young man was unbelievable. But my daughter, I think soon. She just started going to a second generation and a third generation, because she's both.
Right, because of her.
And 3G. And my grandson is 4G. And my granddaughter is 4G, and my two granddaughters. I would say to them, there is no internet, there is no main focus organization, including the museum, that will gather everyone together under one mission and get the word out. You know, you got Federation, you got UJA, you got the ADL, actually the outgoing president of the ADL, managing director of the ADL, Abe Foxman, wrote the preface to my dad's book. Mm-hmm. His family, my family, were friends in Vilna.
Do you have a message that you would like to give to the future generation or to people listening right now?
The message is very clear and concise. If you let what's going on happen, the generations to come will not have it easy in America or the world.
Yeah.
So we need to figure out and put our best foot forward to get rid of it, to get rid of the anti-Semitism, to get rid of the hate.
Exactly.
And we gather all our resources and we fight, we'll be there. It's education. It's, you know, it's like anything else, you know.
And I mean, to what you were saying before, I think that there's still anti-Semitism nowadays. And you can see what's going on right now. All of these celebrities are like Kanye West. They're saying these downright nasty things and people are just letting it slide. Yeah. And that can't be happening anymore.
Oh, except for Nike. They cut up his contract.
Well, yes, but the fact that people are still listening to him.
That's not enough. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
They should not give him any air time. They shouldn't give him any press time. You know, anything else, you know, I mean, we lived in Manhattan. 20 years. We knew what Trump was.
Yeah.
He still is. And here he has a Jewish son-in-law.
Yeah.
That he's just that kind of person. I mean, there are certain things that people will not. I mean, even when my middle brother, who I don't talk to anymore, Murray, ran for Senate in New Jersey. He went to his announcement reception.
Right.
It was skinheads in there. He was a Republican. I took him aside. I said, why are you letting these people, you know, mom and dad went through? You have to. Thankfully, my mother stayed. My father and I walked out. We didn't, you know, we would have done something that we wouldn't have been happy with.
Right.
Even my wife stopped me. We were taking a train from New Jersey. We lived in New Jersey in Edison, K-12, when our kids went to K-12 in New Jersey, and then when they weren't coming back, we moved to Manhattan. They said, while they were in college and not coming back to New Jersey, I said, good, I don't want to be in New Jersey either. Mm-hmm. So riding a train one day, and the skinheads on the train. And I almost started, my wife stopped me, and I almost started something. It's like someone said to me, you want to take after your father? I said, yeah. I have this ingrained desire to really figure out, while I'm alive, to get this done, you know. And even my dad, you know, in Germany, he spoke all over Europe about what happened. And I remember him speaking to the Hebrew school that my, you know, that my kids went to in Edison, and he spoke in, his accent would go away miraculously when he spoke in front of people. Spoke like a real American.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when I went to visit him, I was the last one to see him when he passed away in the hospital. I said, "Dad, you can come with me. The doctors are telling me there's nothing wrong. The nurses are telling me there's nothing wrong. I said, you can come with me to Manhattan. We have extra room. We have, two bedrooms. And, he was a taxi driver. So he knew Manhattan. You can come with us." He says, "No, I'm not. I'm done. I'm finished. I just didn't want to be around anymore." It's like, you have this premonition. He was, it was almost like a movie. Everywhere he went, he knew what was going to happen. Hmm. And he got out at just the right time. Every mission he went on, even the book, the last chapter, the Russians asked him to go on a mission after the war. And he said, "If I go on this mission, I have a wife and a baby. They will never see me again."
Yeah.
So I'm declining. Of course, the person they sent never came back.
Right.
So that's, we will figure it out. If more young people like yourself, and ironic enough, the March to Maria people does a decent job. We just went to a luncheon. They're part of Federation. But they don't do enough. They need to do more.
Yeah, exactly.
So, are you still in junior high school or high school?
So I'm in Montreal, so we have a different education system.
Yeah, it's different.
I think to the American, I'm in ninth grade, so I would be in high school back in the States. Here I'm in high school too, but...
Yeah, when we were, I had three offices in Toronto, and the Canadian government actually helped get us started in my second business, EHI, PC, et cetera. The Montreal government invited us to lunch. Bart and I flew up, of course. And they said we have to have everything translated in order to teach. I said, it'll cost us a fortune. Mm-hmm. Unless you want to give us the money to teach people how to use their PCs in two languages. Mm-hmm. Finances are just not there. So we didn't expand to Toronto. But we did. I mean, we didn't expand to Montreal. We did some work in Montreal. The Bank of Montreal was one of our clients.
Yeah, I
miss my people in Toronto. They're still, I owe them a visit. I still have a lot of friends, of employees that used to work for me. And the ironic part about it is that everybody that's ever worked for me is gainfully employed and successful.
Yeah.
So I instill that. Get it to the next level, people.
Yeah.
All you have to do is sorry. All right, so enjoy your weekend.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and send me the link when you, what do you call it? And maybe I'll take you up on it. Once my back gets better, we'll do a TikTok.
Yeah. And if you're ever down in Montreal, just send over an email or something.
I will get on a plane and we'll go to Montreal. We all Montreal will visit as well.
Yeah.
West Palm has, I believe, direct flights to Montreal or Fort Lauderdale. It's only an hour flight, 2 hours at the most.
Yeah.
New York was about an hour.
So thank you so much.
You got it.
Join me next time when I talk to Victor David, a marvelous man with a great memory who speaks over 10 languages. If you like this episode, please like and subscribe and tell your friends. This is Eliane Goldstein. Tune in next time to The Effect on Us. And remember, history will not repeat itself. Bye!